Mike Rowe. You know who Mike Rowe is? Mike Rowe is the host of Dirty Jobs, the Discovery Channel series that takes viewers into the heart of some of the most grueling, gross, and downright bizarre jobs out there. Over the years, Mike has rolled up his sleeves and tackled everything from scraping the slime off fish hatcheries to diving into septic tanks, all with his signature blend of humor and resilience. Some of his worst assignments include shoveling animal entrails in a slaughterhouse, cleaning out a clogged sewage system, and working in the guts of a trash compactor. And through it all, Mike showcases not his own work, but the unsung heroes who do the tough, dirty works that keeps the world running. I wonder if you've ever had a job like that. One of those underbelly jobs that you feel like keeps the world running. Somehow managing to keep his cool, even when things get seriously messy. Mike Friesen had a dirty job. I've had a few of them. Mike Friesen's dirtiest job was, well, let's say it gently, doctoring pigs. At the time, I was working as a teenager on a ranch out west, and we were focused on beef and putting up hay. And the small herd of pigs that was on the homestead there kind of got neglected. And they got bigger than they should have been before they got doctored. All right, you with me? Before they got doctored. And well, it was hot summer, mud wrestling frenzy before we got that job done. None of us were allowed to enter the house with our clothes on. We were took it off outside in the shelter belt and sprayed down out there. When you do a dirty job, you get dirty. When you do a dirty job, you get dirty. Levi had a dirty job. Oh, he was probably one of the wealthiest people around, but he had a dirty job. In the eyes of his community, he got dirty. And people wondered, how could Jesus stay clean if he's friends with dirty Levi? How can Jesus stay clean if he's friends with dirty Levi? I believe in this little exchange, which we've already read this morning, Jesus is saying, don't get me wrong, I came to save sinners, not rally the righteous. And that's a pretty profound message for one who has come and is representing himself as the Messiah. Not to rally the righteous, but to save sinners. In our first message from Mark's gospel, we looked at an extraordinary passage in the middle of the book. It indicated that Mark wants to take us first to the conclusion of a disciple. The conclusion of a disciple. That Jesus is the Son of God, the anointed King. And then secondly, Mark wants to take us on the journey of a disciple. We've concluded what a disciple concludes. Now to go on the journey of a disciple, the discovery that this anointed king is the servant savior of the world. And that seeing him and identifying, following him into that, we'll be drawn into service and ministry to the world as well. Now we've gone back. Having made that first observation, we're gone back and we're zeroing in on the controversies and the clarifications where Jesus says, now don't get me wrong, here's the real Messiah. And today we come back to chapter 2 for the calling of Levi. Let's look at it again and look at it a little bit more closely. Verse 13 is where this story begins. He went out again beside the sea. This is after the healing, the letting down of the paralytic from last week. And he went out again beside the sea, and all the crowd was coming to him, and he was teaching them. And as he passed by, so there's movement here that Mark doesn't fill in for us, so he teaches them. And then he's passing by, and he sees Levi, the son of Alphaeus, sitting at the tax booth, and he said to him, follow me. And he rose and followed him. And as he reclined at table in his house, many tax collectors and sinners were reclining with Jesus and his disciples, for there were many who followed him. There are many at this point in Jesus' career who are following him. So don't be thinking simply of 12 disciples or four who are inner circle disciples. Think of everyone sort of generally being considered disciples, those who are following. So note here, first of all, challenging people's assumptions, Jesus invited religious pariahs to follow him and to fellowship with him. A pariah, meaning one who's excluded, right? But it has a stigma to it. It's an outsider with an attitude. Someone who is excluded for good reason. Pastor Brian Bell explains Levi's situation beautifully. Listen, Capernaum was on the caravan route between the east and the west, so it was a perfect place to set up a tax booth. He collected on imports and exports, on bridges, roads, and harbors. He would tax the number of axles on a wagon, the number of legs on a donkey, and charge a pedestrian tax if someone was out walking. A little bit of facetious, right? He also charged taxes on the number of fish the fishermen caught. Tax collectors were dishonest. They were known to overcharge people, and when someone couldn't pay, they'd be given a high-interest loan. They took bribes from the rich and extorted the poor. They were disqualified. Tax collectors were not allowed to give testimony as witnesses because no one trusted them. Their tithes weren't even accepted at the temple. They were disloyal. Though he was Jewish, he was considered a traitor because he worked for the Romans. That's where these taxes went. He worked for the Romans. He had turned his back on his family, his nation, and his God. They were detested. Tax collectors were classed with murderers and robbers. Only they were considered the worst. Jewish people despised them more than Roman officials or soldiers. Sometimes children would come up and spit at tax collectors, encouraged to do so by their parents. All right? Disgraced. By extension, Levi's family would have also been ostracized by the community. He was a letdown to his family. He was a source of their shame. Lastly, they were defiled. He was considered an outcast and was excommunicated from the synagogue. According to the rabbis, there was no hope for a loser like Levi. He was working in the muck, and by reason of his work, he was part of the problem. He was filthy. He was dirty. He should not be associated with at any cost. Like I said in worship this morning, good news for you if you feel like you snuck in somehow among the saints. It isn't true. It isn't true. That's a mirage. Christ's table of fellowship is crowded edge to edge and elbow to elbow with sinners just like you. It's a common misnotion of the church. People outside think those among us here believe that we're better than them, more holier than thou, that we consider ourselves saints in a world of sinners. Instead, the true picture is that we are saints because we have admitted we're sinners. We're saints because we have admitted, humbled ourselves, and said, Lord, count me among the sinners, welcome at your table. That's how Levi's community saw him. Here's a question. How do you see a sinner? How do you see a sinner? The cynic answers that question, just open your eyes, they're everywhere. Bitter people say, go boating on Sunday, they're everywhere you want to be. Yeah? The trapper says, leave cookies on a table, sit back, watch, you'll see a sinner. A citizen says, follow my tax payment. And my next one, and my next one, and my next one. Follow the money, you'll find a sinner. Too often a Christian says, as seldom as possible, see a sinner as seldom as possible. Pharisee says, from a long way off. That was the thing, distance. You distance yourself from those who are tax collectors and sinners. Jesus, though, apparently wasn't worried about getting a little dirty, was he? Apparently, he wasn't worried by the stigma that the sinners and the tax collectors had. Of course, I'm not talking literally. How do you see a sinner? I'm talking about what's your view of unbelievers? What's your perspective? What's your disposition toward? What's your bias when it comes to unbelievers? And here we need to get a little bit more serious. You see, learning to see the world of unbelievers as God sees it is the first step towards becoming comfortable with and competent in sharing good news. We need to see sinners and tax collectors the way God does. Stereopsis is, any ophthalmologists here? Stereopsis is an aspect of normal, healthy vision. Here's how it works. First, both eyes have to be accurately aimed at the same object. Interesting. I never thought about this. I've had professors at a couple of schools who had eyes that weren't accurately aimed at the same object. And it was always amusing to sit in class and wonder, is he looking at me now? Or where's that other eye going? They didn't both aim in the same direction, but in stereopsis, they're aimed at the same target. That's binocular vision, but it's not yet stereoscopic vision. And then because the two eyes are located in different positions, all my professors did have that, two eyes in different positions, they're aimed at the same object from a little different angle, aren't they? You wouldn't think, well, not much, but yeah, they're a little different angle. And then finally, those two separate, unique images are sent onto the brain for processing, where the two images arrive simultaneously and are united into a unique picture, stereoscopic vision. You see, we need to have stereoscopic vision when it comes to seeing the world the way God does. There's tension created for us by the fact that God is both absolutely loving and dazzling pure in his holiness. Now this, we might think of that in terms of attention being pulled in. Well, so am I supposed to love that sinner unconditionally, or am I supposed to rebuke him for his sin, his lack of righteousness, his lack of holiness? What am I supposed to do here? I feel a tension. Let's think of it more in terms of stereoscopic vision. See, that tension isn't alive in the heart of God. He can do both of those without impugning his own character. When we see with the stereoptic vision, we can maintain both love and the standard of holiness when we look at the world. We see those two things coming together. So listen, to be very practical here, if we're going to follow in the footsteps of Jesus and not be afraid to get a little dirty around the people that Jesus is still searching for, it's okay to experience a righteous anger when confronted by the sin of the world. But don't excuse yourself from loving sinners because your righteousness is offended. Jesus didn't. You see, Jesus' righteousness in that sense was always offended by the people around him. Less than his holy standard. But that didn't stop him from moving in close. Again, it's okay to have an enormous affinity with the unbelievers that you work with. You don't feel guilty that your heart is really knit to them. Don't feel guilty that you actually love them. Don't just pretend to. Don't feel bad about loving the unbelievers, but balance that. don't excuse yourself from proclaiming the truth. Your affinity is not an excuse from proclaiming the truth. Now, maybe we've felt that tension between the love of God and the holiness of God. The Pharisees never did. They were completely free from any of that tension. It was holiness all the way, right? So verse 16, and the scribes of the Pharisees, when they saw that he was eating with sinners and tax collectors, said to his disciples, why does he eat with tax collectors and sinners? Now, I don't read a wholesale attack here. There's not that much controversy that has taken place in Jesus' ministry to this point. All right, so it's not a wholesale attack. I read a mix of curiosity and a little tinge of accusation. So it's kind of like there's much to like in Jesus' teaching, but why does he? It's kind of like that. It's an investigation. Verse 17, and when Jesus heard it, he said to them, those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick. I came not to call the righteous, but sinners. Now, those who objected to Jesus' connections then asked why a perceived Jewish teacher would do such a thing. And he overheard them, and he gave them a proverb that indicated he was with the people who needed him the most, right? He gives them this lovely little proverb. Those who are well have no need of a physician. And it could have ended there. It could have ended there. It might be that the doctor proverb, follow me here, is simply followed up by Jesus' direct application to the righteous sinner situation. He might just be saying, here's the proverb, in case you missed it, unless you're a little slow, you don't like word pictures. Here's me laying it out. It could just be like that. But listen, here are these scribes of the Pharisees who maintain their scrupulous distance from the sinners. They are the righteous. They are the righteous. Now, don't get me wrong. Not in God's eyes. Not in the perspective of the one who really counts. But the Pharisees, put yourself in their shoes. They're sitting here listening to Jesus' answers. I have not come to call the righteous. And they would have gone, you're leaving me out? I'm the righteous. Oh, wait a minute. You got a club going and I'm kind of starting to like it. And you just said, I haven't come to include, to make members of, to rally. The righteous don't get it. You see what I'm saying? They wouldn't have just read this or heard this and been able to keep themselves out of the application. I have not come to call you righteous ones. What? We're always the inside group. We're always the ones. We're the popular ones. What do you mean you haven't come to call us? No, I've come to call sinners. Let me say it another way. After Jesus says, those who are well have no need of a physician, I imagine the Pharisees nodding in approval. Good answer. I love that proverb. Lord knows these people are not well. And when he continues and says, I came not to call the righteous, they say, nodding, what? You see, the second part would have taken it further than just the proverb. It pushed it a little bit farther, and it started to step on the toe just a bit. The Pharisees then found themselves in a dilemma. Jesus' answer made them consider whether they would insist on their personal righteousness and exclude themselves from Jesus' call, or admit their sinners and be welcomed at his table of fellowship. So the party's going on. And now they've got to, I'm asking why sinners are included here. And Jesus says, guess what? No righteous. That is, no self-proclaimed righteous people get to sit here. This is a little bit more of a tease than we often give it credit for. Because you see, admitting they were sinners would take a seismic shift in their understanding of sin, wouldn't it? Okay, I want to be in. You want me to start collecting taxes? You want me to be an immoral person? You don't want me to disobey the Sabbath? You know, these are the rules. I know the rules. Jesus said, no, you're going to have to think way bigger than your simple rules-based standard of righteousness. Sinner would have to be redrawn to include Pharisees who are only righteous by their own standard. It's going to be sinners going to have to start creeping out into, well, close here and maybe even include me if I'm not careful. And I think this is very instructive in our pluralistic society today. You see, there are very few sinners left in the world. Have you noticed that? Yeah, I'll bet you take the afternoon, it's going to be warm, do a survey. Very few people out there are saying, yep, yeah, that's me. Oh, no, there are very few sinners left in the world today. We've got good old boys. We got misguided children. We've got gals who've lost their way. We've got unenlightened souls. But sinners, they're almost extinct, which is really surprising given the amount of evil that remains in the world. Sinners are almost extinct. A little bit different in Jesus' day. In Jesus' day, everyone walked around with a consciousness of sin. Only some denied it was their problem. In our day, no one believes in sin anymore. No one believes in sin anymore. And that's a challenge for those of us who want to follow in Jesus' footsteps. Have you ever tried to convince someone that they're a sinner? Do you think it's important that they know or they come to that conclusion before they're ready to hear the good news of Jesus Christ? It's difficult. It's difficult, and I think there's a little bit of modeling in Jesus here, too. He doesn't just turn the tables and say, guess what? It's the people in my company who are the righteous. You are the doggone dirty sinner. He doesn't flip it like that. He says it in such a way that makes them think they would have gone away and thought, did he just suggest that I'm not welcome with my standard of righteousness? I would definitely say I'm not a sinner, but am I righteous? I think Jesus does a good job of encouraging these people to begin to think whether they might be better off being a sinner close to Jesus than being righteous and excluded from his company. I believe in this little exchange, Jesus is saying, don't get me wrong, I came to save sinners, not rally the righteous. This was really big news. Really big news, because if he was purporting to be the Messiah, then their conception was that that was exactly what he was supposed to do. Come as a gift from heaven to rally the righteous and reclaim their national heritage on the stage of the world. And Jesus said, no, I've got a bigger work that needs to be done. I need to save this. This is still big news, isn't it? This is still big news. It means that the accusations that churches like ours are little gatherings of people that they think they're better than the rest of the world have missed the point completely. Have missed the point completely. This gathering is a group of people who've said, I'm a sinner. Thank God I'm welcomed in Jesus Christ. That's the identity of our congregation. We're people who have said, I am no better on my own than any other person. I have found the grace of God in Jesus Christ, and by that grace, I am welcomed into fellowship. Serving sinners is a dirty job, and Jesus wasn't above rolling up his sleeves. How about us? In this story, Jesus, first of all, took notice of sinners. For us, the heart of the story is the developments after it. But the very fact that Jesus, as he was passing by, takes notice of the excluded one, the pariah, the one who's the really bad sinner, right? Says, follow me. Follow me. And begins a new journey for Matthew, whose name was originally Levi. He saw him with compassion. And we need to do the same thing. And this might take some work, because I tell you, if we're not very, very careful, our churches do become a training ground for Pharisees, right? If we're not very careful, we do begin to get the approach and the attitude that, you know what, we are better. We are better. Well, I hope in the sense that we live lives that are more godly than pagans. Yeah, I hope so. Is that essentially better, or is that by the grace of God? That's the grace of God at work in your life. So we dare not become Pharisees. We need to look at the sinners, the ones that we find offensive, and look on them, even them, with compassion. With compassion, with that divine theological stereopsis that says, there by God's grace go I. Secondly, Jesus encouraged those who considered themselves the entitled righteous that they would be better off as sinners called to join his party. And here's where we might find fruit in our own desires to share the gospel. Since there are so few sinners left in the world today, I wonder if we might consider this idea of approaching the righteous side of it. Not necessarily are you bad enough to be excluded, are you good enough to be included? I wonder if we could work that angle a little bit as Jesus did here, and that we might help people little by little, through our love and our friendship, to consider, you know what? My friend who is a follower of Jesus is not the kind who says, I'm righteous and you're a sinner. He's actually doing a spiritual judo on me, saying, I'm the sinner. And that's why I follow Jesus. And that's why Jesus has found me, and I have been found by his grace. Let's follow Jesus in this ministry of his. Let's not be afraid to roll up our sleeves, do a dirty job, mix with those people that the religious establishment might say are dirty. Let's go and find them. Let's love them, and let's love them in Jesus' gracious name. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, we thank you for, again, the life of Jesus and his fabulous ministry of love and compassion. We're grateful that he took the initiative into going into the places where those excluded from the rules of spirituality still needed to find life, and that he welcomed them in, and that he said, you too can be a follower. This was just the beginning. I don't know where Levi came to faith. Maybe it was down there in chapter 8. Maybe when Peter confessed, you're the Messiah, you're the Son of God. Maybe that crystallized it, and it all came together, and it gelled, and it made sense. And maybe Levi's heart leaped at it at that moment. I don't know, but here, even before all had been revealed by Jesus about his mission, Levi said, yeah, there's a guy I could follow. There's one I'd be willing to listen to. And I cherish the notion that I could be accepted in that company. Let us let people know that they could be accepted as a seeker in the community of Converge Church, where grace is abundant and where we're eager to share what we have found in a loving Savior.